Blog Talk Radio.
Original. I never heard that before. It's definitely not my kind of music, but okay. It's definitely different. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Focus Discussion, and we have an outstanding show today, and I hope we get tons of people in the chat room to ask some questions. We have New York Times bestselling author Tess Gerritsen here, and she is the author of the Rizzoli and Isle series and a whole bunch more books. And I have to tell you, I've read every single one of them, and I don't know why you guys don't go on Amazon right now while you're listening to me at the same time and buy it. And my favorite book in hers is The Bone Garden, so if you haven't read it, I don't know what's wrong with you. Hi, Tess. How are you?
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. We are going to talk about Tess's latest release, which I don't know why these people are waiting to buy it. I have no idea. But, you know, Christmas and Hanukkah are coming up, and books are really great. And when you go visit someone, yeah, just hand them a book instead of a bottle of wine. It's so much better.
Oh, I wish people would do that. Just think how many bottles of wine are sold today.
Just think about how many books could be sold instead of the wine, and then they'd be safer driving on the street.
People can lend it out. You can't do that once you've drunk the bottle of wine.
This is true. You just throw out the bottle, and then it's polluted. So we're going to talk about Last to Die, which happens to be my favorite of all of the Rizzoli and Isles books, because it hits home when it talks about education. That's my field. So could you tell everybody something about the book?
Well, it's the 10th in the Rizzoli and Isles series, and the basic plot is this. There are three children who have all survived really horrible things that happened to them 2 years before the book starts. Their families were all murdered, and these are the only survivors of their families. Now they're living in their foster families, and within a week, all their foster parents are killed. These kids don't know each other. They live in different cities. What is it that ties their fates together? And that's where Jane and Maura come into the story and have to figure it out. Not only figure it out, but they have to keep these three children safe because whatever is after them is still out there.
Yeah, I know, and it scared me just from reading the first chapter. So how come you decided on the main storyline for this, and why did you decide to name the guy Icarus?
Well, the main storyline, it comes from two different things. First, you know, I was a doctor, and I used to work in a head injury unit where we had patients who, when you have a brain injury, there are a couple of things that happen. You become impetuous. You do things without thinking ahead of time, and you also have a messed up sleep-wake cycle. So I thought, what if I put these characteristics into a 13-year-old girl? And that's the character of Claire Ward, one of these three orphans, because not only is she 13, which gives her a teenage brain, she also has an injury because she was shot in the head 2 years earlier. And she wanders at night. She sees things. So, the story kind of started because I had this focus on a particular character, this 13-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. But I was also interested in this idea of a student criminal justice club, kids who solve crimes. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be like Nancy Drew. I wanted to be a detective. So I thought, well, let's put my childhood fantasies into this, and let's have a whole club of child detectives, teenage detectives, who become really important to solving this case. The name Icarus, which is one of the characters, you don't really know who Icarus is, and maybe you'll find out as you get to the end of the story. I have a great love of mythology, Greek and Roman mythology, so I pulled it out of that, you know, the creature who, the one who flew too close to the sun and died because of it, so that was the inspiration for that name.
I absolutely loved it. I thought that was a great way to start the story and create a little suspense and danger. But yeah, this book really is amazing. And of course you hear the voice of Icarus throughout the book, which makes it even scarier. And throughout the plot, when they read this, they're not going to believe the ending. Well, I'm not going to tell them anything anyway. They have to read it for themselves.
I don't think anybody has guessed the ending yet. I mean, everybody always tells me they were completely shocked. So it'll be fun to find out if anybody is smart enough to figure it out.
I usually figure it out, but this was like, oh, my God, no. I actually thought I knew, and then I was saying, oh, my God, this is so clever. I think you're going to stump everybody, and I think if anybody really does figure it out, they probably turn to the last page first and cheat it.
Okay. Well, that's our challenge then to my readers. Did you figure it out?
they're going to tell you that, but you know what? It's not true.
Okay.
Someone's going to say, yeah, Tess, I figured it out. And you're going to say, what did you figure out and how? You know what? Don't worry. There are a lot of people that are listening. Hi there, people. If anybody has a question in the chat room, please put it in the chat room, and I will ask it when I can, and I will definitely ask your questions. So Claire Ward was supposed to have a date with death. How did she escape? And why did she just decide to go against her foster parents, typical kid?
Well, she's a typical kid, exactly. She's a 13-year-old rebellious teenager who also, had a brain injury. So she feels like she's kind of the weirdo and is always trying to run out at night to wander because she doesn't sleep at night. So while she's out there, an attempt is made on her life that unfortunately takes the deaths of her foster parents. And she escapes because a mysterious person shows up. And she doesn't know who, the reader doesn't know who she is. All we know is it's a beautiful blonde woman dressed in black who says, come with me if you want to live. And that's the end of the scene.
That's enough to give you the chills, let me tell you. Definitely enough to give you the chills. I have a question about traumatic brain injury then, because this is something that I'm familiar with, unfortunately. Because she had this head injury, this lasts forever, so that would explain her behavior. So if a child has a concussion, or this was more than a concussion, it was a head, you know, a shot in the head, or concussion, that could affect you throughout your life?
It can. It can lead to problems continually with impulsiveness. The patients we saw in my rehab unit, we had to be careful with them. We had to watch over them. Because they would run across the street without thinking about the consequences.
Mm.
They also, you know, if they want something, they'll just take it without thinking about the consequences. So, there's a theory that a large percentage of people in our prison system are not really criminals, but they have had some sort of injury as a child, and that they've lost that impulse control, and that could be why they end up in jail. So it's there is an organic, there's certainly an organic facet to our behavior.
And there's nothing that anybody could do to straighten. In other words, if a kid gets 3 head injuries like that playing football, I mean, my nephew's had 3 concussions. So 3 injuries like that, that could cause something like that, and there was nothing that anybody could do about it?
It's hard. I mean, unless you, what you're going to have to do is train them or make them aware of this issue. Sometimes they have a certain amount of control if they think about it continually. You know, if they know, I have to stop and think, you know, and that's something that needs to be trained.
That is scary, yeah. So that if someone, like this child or anybody, and any one of these 3 kids had a head injury and somebody saw them, in other words, the smart thing would be to call for help and not do anything about it and not move them.
You just have to be careful. And it's surprising how even small traumas can cause, some brain problems. And when your frontal lobes go, you just lose a lot of impulse control.
So who is this next one? Who is Will?
Will Vyablonsky, he's a 14-year-old boy with an interesting hobby. His hobby is stargazing. He's an amateur astronomer, so he's out in the field at night with his telescope. He's searching. He wants to be a discoverer of a comet. Now, comets are found all the time by amateurs, and he wants to join the ranks, but there's really kind of a sad reason he's out there. He wants to find a comet and name it after his dead father. That's his way of honoring the father he lost 2 years earlier. And while he's in there, he's his aunt and uncle are asleep in the farmhouse, and the farmhouse explodes. And Will lives just because he happens to be out looking at the stars.
He was really lucky. It's almost by chance that all of these three kids are alive. It's just by chance.
Yeah.
Or maybe not, people, because we're not going to tell you the real reason.
Yeah, we're not going to tell you. Or maybe not.
That's exactly right, because these three kids were singled out, and there's a third one. There's Teddy.
Who is perhaps the most unfortunate of the group, because when he is now living in a very nice foster family in Boston, and somebody comes in the middle of the night and kills the whole family. And Teddy survives only because he hides under a bed and turns off his light, and the killer doesn't know he's there. So that's where Jane comes into the story, because now this is a Boston homicide case.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane, being the only woman homicide detective, is sort of like shoved into taking care of Teddy, because they figure, well, you're a mom, you watch the boy. And she's the only one who can really talk to Teddy and finds out about his past history, that his real parents were killed 2 years earlier. And then there's another attempt, or she thinks it's an attempt on Teddy's life, and now she thinks, I've got to keep this boy safe. And he's only 14, but he has an issue with, he has a little bit of Asperger's syndrome, so he doesn't relate well to other children.
Well, that brings me to the other question. There's like a second plot in this story, right? There's not just the three teenage kids that go to this school, that are sent to the school, but then there's Jane and her mother and her boyfriend and
yes.
her father, which I found like I can't wait for Angela to decide which one she's going to pick. Yeah, just how come you brought that up especially? I mean, when you brought up the fact that she was wearing this ugly pink dress, I cracked up laughing. I go, yeah, my mother would do that too. So how come you brought that?
Well, you know, the thing is... Jane, the whole series, through 10 books, what I've done is I follow these people through their lives, their families. It's like a real group of people. Mm-hmm. I feel like I know these people. They're my friends. And you always want to know how your friend's mom is doing. And
yeah.
so I bring in Angela. And, you know, Jane has a really complicated family. They give her hell a lot. She has
this is true.
Two brothers. And then then a couple books ago, there was a problem with Jane's father walked out on her mother. And moved in with a bimbo. So Jane's mom has had to deal with learning to be a single, an abandoned wife. She's found love again, and now all of a sudden Jane's dad walks back into the picture, wants his wife back, and now Jane's mom has to make a decision. Do I go with my husband who left me earlier, or do I marry this man I now love? And because she's Catholic and she's very conservative when it comes to family matters, and because her sons want the family back together again, she's fighting on all sides. Does she follow happiness, or does she do her duty and remake this family?
Well, we're not going to tell you what she does, but I have my own opinion about doing your duty when you're unhappy.
I know everybody has their opinion, and everybody seems to share the same thought of what Angela should do.
Yeah, well, Vince is a nice guy, and Frank needs help.
So you'll find out at a future book. I don't know the answer. It comes to me as I'm writing it.
We know. You're not going to get all the answers, people, because otherwise the series would end and that wouldn't have been any fun.
No.
These murders take center stage, and with a close friend, Moira, they go to the scene of the crime. So what is her first reaction when she finds out what happens to Teddy Clark and where he winds up, and how do these three teens wind up in the same place?
Well, these three teens end up, they end up in the same place because they are... they're there to be protected. They're there to be kept safe. And the issue is that this school that they're in is a very it's a very remote school, and it's the one place that they can find that other people are there to take care of them. And the school is run by an organization called the Mephisto Society, and they are there to help kids who have they have an issue. All these children have been. They have been survivors of crimes, and they're there to heal and also to learn that how to fight back and how to be warriors. And so imagine a high school where you go, and instead of physics class, you learn about blood splatters. I mean, that's amazing, right? So this is the kind of school it is.
Well, there's a lot more about the school that we're going to talk about, because there's a lot more to their program that Jane feels that what they're doing. But meanwhile, she's working with a Detective Crow. And even though he picked her to do this particular case, why does he get so upset when she does it? He doesn't like that she's taking the lead, and he doesn't like the fact that she's actually getting something done. He resents her. Why?
Well, I think that, are you talking about Darren Crow?
Yeah, I don't like him.
Yeah, well, you know what, there's always been a rivalry between them. I think it's the male-female rivalry, and also because he doesn't like uppity women, and there she is.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
He doesn't like the fact that she knows what she's doing, too.
That's right.
But I do have to throw one in. I mean, I'm still missing that other guy from the last book, you know, Tan. We got to bring him
back. Oh, yeah. Well, he may be coming back. We don't know. He may be coming back.
He should, because he's cute. And he's tough. And he aggravates, you know. He's perfect for Jane as a partner.
Yeah.
But that's just my opinion.
Well, we'll see. I mean, right now, we're not sure. I'm not sure how anything is going to happen. So we'll find out.
She didn't write the next one yet, but she's going, so that's a hint,
yeah,
people.
Yeah,
so what happens when she meets Teddy, and how is she going to get him to trust her when he's really afraid?
Well, she's going to have to turn on all her motherly instincts and try and get Teddy to work with her. And I think the real issue right now is, you know, how does she get a story out of Teddy? Because he's not really ready to talk to her or about what's going on, these details. I mean, I think this is something that, this is a piece of information that she needs to find out, is who came into the house, who killed all these people. And Teddy is so frightened and so almost silent that he can't quite tell her.
Well, he's sort of like shell-shocked in a sense.
Yeah,
he can't say. But there's a whole lot more to him, too, but we just won't tell anybody what that is.
Right.
Okay, so... Who is Thomas More, and why does he want to help Jane?
Well, Thomas More is, he's a cop that actually came about, he was in the very first book that Jane showed up in called The Surgeon, and he was the detective who was helping to investigate, you know, these serial murders by a man named Warren Hoyt. And Thomas More has continued to be on the force all this time, you know, in and out of the story. So he is there as part of this investigative team that's investigating what happened to Teddy's foster family.
Now we have Claire, who's trying to help connect all of them. And I'm not going to ask that question because we don't want everybody to know how they connect. We can't tell them that part. So you brought my favorite character back in this book. And that would be Julian Perkins or Rat. So why is he connected to this? I love this kid. He's so cool.
Well, Julian Perkins, he saved Maura's life in the book Ice Cold.
Yeah.
And she has always felt this, you know, this attachment to him, because she, you know, Maura doesn't have, she doesn't have a family. She doesn't have a husband. She doesn't have children. But Julian is almost like her son, and she wants to be his mother, and he's an orphan, so he's now attending the Evensong School, and she is going to go visit him, and that's where all these kids come together, because they've all been surviving crimes, they're all stuck at the school, and when Maura arrives, strange things begin to happen.
Well, we're not going to tell them what strange things, but they're sort of glad she's there, but the people that are running this school are really not that thrilled that she's there at this point. So how do the people at the school react to the murders, and why do they think the school is safe when we know that it just might not be?
Well, it's safe because it's run by the Mephisto Society, and it's got incredibly, you know, strong security and big fences and teachers who are paying attention to everything and being careful to protect these children. So you would think it's a safe place for all these kids to come to, and this is where Jane brings Teddy, just to make sure that no one can get at him. And that's when she gets there, she realizes maybe it's not such a safe place, because strange things begin to happen. Somebody hangs these bloody dolls in a tree. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff that's happening.
Okay, I have a question in the chat room.
Yes.
Someone wants to know, when you wrote this book, did you just start from an outline, or you just sit down and write and hope that the pen goes wherever you want it to go, or the computer?
You know, I just started to write, because I love this idea of kids solving a crime, but I didn't know exactly what was going on. I didn't know what tied these three children together. And it was in the middle of the writing that the story starts to come clear to me, and I begin to figure out what the mystery is. And that's, you know, so I actually figured out the last couple pieces of the puzzle only at the end. And when it happens and you suddenly come up with the answer, it's like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. So if it excites me or surprises me, I figure it must surprise my readers as well.
Well, when they read this ending, they're going to be totally surprised. They're not going to believe, you know, what the ending is, and they're not going to believe the little twist that everybody has. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
You could write a little bit more. I'm not even going to say it. I mean, you know, with Tessa's book, you never know which one's going to have a sequel and which one's not.
Right, right.
You know, where you could bring some more characters back.
Right.
So the part I loved, I mean, I love this forensics club that these kids belong to. Tell everybody how that works, that the children in this, run by Julian, right, they help to find, but they ask to be able to be part of this when they see the dolls, and they hesitate, but yet they allow them to do this, and they do a good job.
Yeah, well, you know, it started because it goes back to the early beginnings of the school. The Jackals Club, which is the name of the forensics club, was started by an earlier student, and Julian is now the elected president of this club. And they start to figure out. They want to figure out who's hanging these dolls. You know, what's going on? You know, what kind of person would kill? And it turns out one of the school's chickens is killed. Who killed the chicken? And it seems like a trivial little case, but as the book goes on, you realize these are not trivial events.
Yeah, there's more. There are other murders that take place, too.
Yeah.
If they want to know who else is killed, they have to read it.
Yeah.
I didn't ask that question. So who is Lily and who is Anthony, and how do they fit into this puzzle?
Well, they come from an earlier book. They come from the Mephisto Club, which is where Anthony first shows up as a main character. And Lily is one of the characters whose life is threatened in the Mephisto Club. And both of them survived that book, and now they've helped to establish the school. They're part of the faculty of the school.
Oh, okay. I just got your thing. We could do this. It's up to you. We could do this for an hour if that's works.
Yeah,
for
I thought an hour.
It's two hours.
Oh, my God.
No, we could do like till about a quarter after 5 minutes, okay?
Okay,
right. That's not a problem. We have somebody by the name of Mary Kate, and she would like to know, I love when people ask questions, have you started writing your next book yet, and when is it coming out for Fran to review? She didn't write that part, but I just added it in.
Well, I am doing the mental work on the next book. It is don't have a title, but I can tell you that it was in pretty much. It started off when I was in South Africa. I was safari, and you know, so you're sitting in safari, you're sitting in this truck, in this jeep, and they're surrounded by animals that can kill you. I mean, there's lions everywhere, and you step out of the truck, you're dead. So I thought, the only thing that's keeping me alive right now is this truck and the ranger who's sitting in front of me, and I need to trust my life to this man. What if he's not who he says he is? And that's when I got that delicious chill that tells me this is going to be my next book.
It sounds very scary, but then you're writing it from real life scary experience, so that's even better.
Yeah. Well, you know, I find that a lot of my best ideas come from being in a situation where I suddenly get a chill, and I think, what if I put a character in this situation, and what if it gets even worse, and what happens next? And that is really where my ideas begin.
That is so amazing. So before I ask more questions about this, because I've got like a million more, what was the very first book you ever wrote?
When I was 7, I wrote a little book about my dead cat, and I bound it together with needle and thread, but you know, my first published book was a romantic suspense novel called Call After Midnight, and it came out in 1987. It's hard to believe it was that long ago.
Wow. And how come I never heard of it?
Well, it still comes out from time to time. It's published now by Mira. The reprints are published by Mira. And, you know, I wrote 9 romantic suspense books before I began thriller writing. And a lot of people don't know that. But they'll sometimes see one of these paperback comes up and go, "Whoa, what's that? Is this a new book?" But it turns out they were written, you know, 20 plus years ago.
Mira is part of St. Martin's, aren't they?
No, Mira is part of Harlequin.
Harlequin. That's
yeah.
why. That's yeah. I have to. I don't have a person over there, but don't worry. If I want it, I'll figure out a way to get it. Because maybe we need.
You know, they're romantic suspense novels, so there is a lot of romance in them, and I know that probably gets a lot of people going, well, wait a minute, where did she write these, you know, where did these come in?
You know, we have to start plugging those because, you know, that would be really, you know, the other side of Tess. You never know.
You never know. That's right. You never know.
So these teens, why are these teens so alone, and how do they learn to live with their lives so shattered? Because, you know, this book would really help even teens if they read it, to me.
Well, I think that, well, first of all, I love teenagers. I mean, it's hard to believe that I could say this, but I raised two sons, and I remember their teenage years, and I remember how much I loved them, you know, and boys in particular, I think, are so vulnerable. They have to pretend they're men, but they're really not.
Mm-hmm.
They're still little boys. So it there's something to me that's very touching about teenagers, and then the idea of teenagers who are so badly damaged, who have lost everything, lost their families. And these three kids in particular, Claire, Will, and Teddy, who are the main trio in this story, they're known as the weirdos. So they have another vulnerability to them, and that vulnerability is that, you know, the kids kind of, they think of them as outcasts. Claire's the head-injured one. Teddy is the one with Asperger's, and Will is the chubby pale astronomer that you know, everybody thinks of as a geek. So these three outcasts are going to have to figure out how to save themselves.
That is, it's scary. And the fact they were in foster care brings up another very important issue as to how well they were really monitored.
Yeah.
And how well these kids are monitored. And the fact that they were, you know, there was a murder in each one of their houses is even scarier. But,
right.
You know, working with kids as long as I, children as long as I do, and dealing with the foster care, what do you think of how well they take care of these children or even monitor or keep track of them? Because from my experience, it's limited. They don't do enough to keep these children safe.
That's true. But these three kids are they're like a special case because somebody is keeping an eye on them. And how good that eye is a good question. But these are sort of special foster kids, and you don't really understand why they're special until later in the book.
That's true, because their safety comes when they finally go to, you know, the Evensong school. That's you know, great, but regular foster kids don't always have that kind of protection or the parents that take them from school. Some of them just do it because they get an awful lot of money.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
That's right.
I know, it's scary. There are tons of, we have like about 30, 40 people in the chat, in the listening right now. So if anybody has a question that they want to ask, please put it in on the chat box, and I will be more than happy to ask your questions because I've got a whole bunch more and I can ask tons. So why does Margaret question the ethics and motives of the school and what they're trying to teach the children, and how does she feel about their true mission? Why does she question it?
Well, you know, she's bothered about that these are victims. These children are victims, and she doesn't want them to feel like they're treated as victims. She also questions the political, the motives of the Mephisto Society. Are they training the next army of crime fighters?
Yeah.
And that bothers her, you know, that she wants her kid, she wants Julian to grow up a normal kid, and here he is surrounded by fellow victims. What is that going to do to him? So that's why she worries about it.
Yeah, well, he doesn't want to. He wants to stay there.
He wants to stay there. He finds that this is the school for him, and he is, for the first time, really excited about school. So he's going to resist it, and I think she's going to realize that this is the perfect place for Julian.
So if you had a son, would you send him there? Seriously, would you send him to Evensong?
Seriously, I probably would not. I think it's a pretty strange. You know, it's a strange place, but I think for a child who is a victim, it's probably a good place for them to heal.
Well, he's kind of a tough kid, so he's not going to, you know, let anybody step on him, Julian. I like him.
I know. And he's learning to be a survivor.
Yeah, he is. He's learning to be a whole lot more than a survivor. Maybe he'll run to become a police detective or something because
that's
he's
right.
really
well,
smart.
You never know. I think you have a future sleuth developing in him.
That's true. So we've said the three dolls are covered in blood. So what does that mean, and why is Julian and his team really, really, really want to find out exactly why this happened? How come they decide they have to be the ones, not the police?
Well, nobody knows what it means. They're just hanging in this tree covered in blood. And one of the chickens has been killed. So the kids think, well, first of all, the kids are being blamed for it. You know, the teachers just assume that one of the kids has done it. And now the kids are all looking at each other, and Julian says, well, why do you look at us? Maybe who knows what's going on? So in a sense, Julian, who is the head of the criminal justice club in their school, decides that maybe the kids should figure this mystery out, because nobody's really looking at it seriously. It's not a prank. And it's scaring the children, and they want to take charge.
Well, we'll see what happens, because actually, if you sit there and think about it, what kind of training do they get when they do this particular thing? In other words, this particular club, what kind of training do they have, or do they put it together by themselves?
Well, what they're learning to do is they're learning to find out the answers for themselves. They're learning, for instance, what are the forensics of tree branches? How do you identify a twig? How do you identify DNA? Is it human blood? Is it chicken blood? You know, things like that. So these kids are really learning to do research, and they are learning to be little forensic scientists.
So this is great. So maybe they should put a course like that in every high school, where kids actually have to go out in the field to learn that. This is great. I wish I had that, because I love forensic science.
I think they
science.
Would.
Great.
I think it would make science a lot more interesting to kids, to learn how something as simple as, a blood type becomes really vital to criminal investigation.
That's very true. So when you do a criminal investigation, what is the first step that they do? In other words, they go to the crime scene. They have to make sure it's not contaminated. I think I've read about 800, of those types of things.
Right.
Well, what is the first thing? In some books, like with Nora Roberts, and I think, a little bit over the top sometimes, they put on all these hazmat suits and they put on booties and whatever. Do they actually do that when you're doing the crime scene? Do they, cover their shoes and stuff to make sure that they don't contaminate it?
You definitely need you definitely need shoe covers, just so you don't want to, to leave your own identifiable footprints all over the place to, contaminate that. You also don't want to track blood home, on your shoes. That would be pretty gross, wouldn't it? So it's to protect you as well as to protect the crime scene. And a lot of times, when I talk to forensic scientists, you have to have hair covers. You have to make sure that you're not shedding hairs there, because people shed hairs wherever they go. Gloves, and if it's, if DNA is going to be really vital to solving that crime, yes, people do cover up.
Because the crime scene can be contaminated so fast. And we have another question in the chat room. I was thinking about this one, too. This is interesting. Mary-Kate would like to know, do you think Moira and Anthony would be good together, and what's going to happen with them?
I think that's an interesting question.
And
I've been playing with this for a long time, and I don't know the answer to it. I'm not quite sure yet. The way the series has been winding up is that I figure things out as it happens. I didn't know, for instance, I didn't know Maura was going to have an affair with a Catholic priest until it happened. So for me, it's like life. It's like real life. There's the unexpected events, and your characters do things you don't expect. There's definitely an attraction between them, but I think that there's another secret that Anthony has that he hasn't revealed yet, and that could be a problem.
It could be a deal breaker there.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know, because if she gets married, then what is she going to do if the Catholic priest comes back and he decides to pit them against each other? If he decides to leave the priesthood, you just never know.
There are choices that may have to be made. It's just like, in a way, it's a mirror to Jane's mom's situation, where she found love, and now her husband's back, and now she has to make a choice, a very painful choice.
So who is Williver, and why does he have to be eliminated?
Oh, that's Dr. Williver.
Yes,
she's a psychologist, and she's, well, you know what? It's hard to answer this question without giving stuff away, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, just you could just tell everybody who she is. We're not going
to
tell.
She's a child psychologist at the Evensong School, and something very bad happens to her. Now the question is, why was she killed? Was it an accident? Did she kill herself, or is there something more nefarious going on here?
And who is Olivia? Let's talk about some of the characters so that we can get these people to really want to get on Amazon and buy this book, because I have my copy and there are five people that are waiting to see if I'm going to give it to them, and I'm not. I can't walk with a Tess Aronson book because there are like 17 people in my family that's, can I have it? No, you can't. Sorry. I keep certain books. They can't have them. No.
Yeah.
I don't get back.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of characters that we're talking about now that you're going to have to read the book to figure it out. But there are, we're talking about Will Yablonsky's mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened to his parents? And this is where Jane has to wade into this mystery, because she's got three kids whose parents are dead, whose foster parents are dead. Where does it start? Where does it all tie in together? So really what she has to do is go back and see what is the relationship between these three children? They don't know each other. They were living in different cities. And she has to go back and look at the crime investigations of the three original murders. Who shot to death Claire's parents? How did that plane crash kill Will's parents? You know, what are the possibilities? And the possibilities she uncovers are, you know, pretty creepy. There are some really strange things, some really strange paths that she has to go down.
And who is Detective Paris, and what part does he play in helping to solve this, or doesn't he?
Well, there are multiple detectives because there are multiple jurisdictions and there are multiple crimes. And so she, you know, Jane is really has to go back and reopen these old investigations that maybe were closed too prematurely. But the real secret is, what did these three kids have something in common, or did their families have something in common that nobody knows about yet?
Well, we can't tell them how they figure that out.
We can't tell them. But we can't, we could also just talk about, you know, Jane and Maura and how they became a TV show. Yeah.
Well, that's why I was, that was my next question. Okay. Where do you see Rizzoli next? In other words, they're both on television and you've got two actresses that play them, but they're so different. How come?
Well, they started off, you know, in different books. It's really funny how these characters came about. This was not planned out that I had I was going to have a series. It started off with a book called The Surgeon, where, you know, Jane was just introduced, and she was a secondary character. She was supposed to die in that book, so I wasn't really thinking a lot about developing her permanently. But then as the book ended, I thought, I really like Jane. You know, I don't know much about her. I want to see her again. So she showed up in the second book called The Apprentice, where I introduced a secondary character named Maura Iles. Didn't really think that she was going to be a big deal or a continuing character, but then I got interested in her. So the books have really kind of grown out of, as if I'm meeting these people and I want to know more and more about them, and I'm just watching them develop. And over time, they become friends. Over time, they become the people who they are. Jane has become happier. She's gotten married. She's had kids. Maura is just continually unhappy, I'm afraid. She just can't find the right man. So I think that this friendship has grown really organically, the way a friendship would when two people are colleagues and are thrown together quite a bit.
Do they ever have any disagreements or discord? See, we're not going to tell you anything more about the book, people, because if you don't buy it, too bad. And you have to understand the title. No, I'm not going to tell them. You can't tell them everything. I have a few more questions about it, but that's going to wait. So do these girls, do they ever have a falling out? Do they ever have any discord where they don't, you know, get along, or they're separate for any reason?
Oh, yeah. Well, like every friend does. I mean, you're always going to have ups and downs with your friends, and so do they. They have their ups and downs started next at the last book, a book called The Silent Girl, where... Yeah, well, this is where they fell apart. You know, Maura is the kind of woman who tells the truth. She's a scientist. It's either the facts stand by her or the facts don't. And she had to testify against a police officer who was accused of killing a prisoner. And her facts are that he did. He killed this person. Now, this was a very, very good cop. This was a cop who was very popular, who Jane Rizzoli really liked. And what Moore did by testifying against a cop and sending him to prison was to sort of defy the thin blue line. She, all the cops are mad at her now because the prisoner who was killed was really scum. So Jane was mad too. So they're, you know, it's now Moore against Boston PD, and she's very lonely now. She's standing alone. She's standing on principle, and they've fallen apart because of that.
Well, I have a question in the chat room, and this is a really interesting one, because since we're talking about the characters, the two of them, Delaney would like to know, what character's growth and progression surprised you the most?
I would say, of all of them, probably Angela.
Yeah,
you know,
I know.
Angela started off as just a, you know, plain, you know, a sort of overbearing mom, and I didn't see that she was going to turn into such an interesting character. But it took her husband leaving her for her to really come into her own. And you know, it may be true actually for a lot of real women that once your husband leaves you, you suddenly have to find your own way in the world. And what came out of Angela was this kind of wild and fun woman who now is in love and is happy and is dancing and is wearing high heels. Who could have known that that would happen to a woman who's in her late 50s? So that's really, I think, what surprised me the most.
There's hope for you people out there that are young.
And there is,
And one more question. Delaney would like to know, what do you find most challenging in your work?
I think what I find most challenging is finishing the book. it's, you know, it's always easy to come up with an idea, a great idea. But then I think the most challenging part is because I don't plot my books out ahead of time, I start to write, and maybe three quarters of the way through I think, now I haven't solved this mystery. What's the answer? I don't know what the answer is. And I have to come up with the solution. And then I have writer's block. So every single book I've written, I get writer's block about that point. And I have to come up with why are people doing what they're doing. It's, you know, it's really the solution to the mystery that drives me crazy.
So when you have writer's block, do you take a walk, drink a cup of coffee, or just stop what you're doing? Because that's a question that a lot of authors, as long as you brought it up,
a lot
of people have writer's block. I mean, where you just say, okay, I'm stuck at this particular thing and I don't know where to go with it. So how do you handle it? Do you just stop what you're doing or just
Sometimes you just have to stop. You know, I do. Mm-hmm. I take a walk. I lie on the couch and stare at the ceiling a lot. I drive. I find that driving, when I'm in the car by myself and I'm driving, a lot of great ideas come to me then. So, I mean, at once, well, I solved a whole, you know, I figured out a whole book once on a 3-hour drive in Texas. So, yes, my car is an important part of my writing toolbox, and I should be able to deduct that.
Okay. One of our readers listeners would like to know where your website is and where you can get your books.
Okay. The website is tessgerritsen.com, but my last name is spelled weird. It's GERRITSEN. And you can find a list of my books there. You can just go on Amazon and just look up the title Last to Die, and my book will pop up.
All of her books will pop up if you go on Amazon and just put her name in the search box in Google. I can tell you that for a fact. And then you could just start from the beginning and read them all, because after all, if you don't read the first Rizzoli and Isles, how are you going to read the last?
Well, okay, that's true.
Yeah, because, you know, they're standalones to a point, but you have to know who everybody is. Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, you got to start from the beginning. So my next question is, what writer's block. So if you're going to have writer's block and you're going to take a 3-hour drive, do you take a tape recorder with you so you can record what you're saying?
No, because
remember all that.
You know, if you really, if it really sticks out in your head and it's really ingenious, you'll remember it. I don't have a tape recorder with me, and I don't even need to jot anything down. Usually, when that moment of genius, that insight comes, that aha moment, it's something that is so revolutionary, you just won't forget it.
Okay, we have another question by Marcia Cook, who is World of Ink. And for those of you that don't know it, I just said Delaney asked two questions, and her new book is coming out, The Ninja Tattoo. So I just want everybody to know that, because I'm going to get it to review. I want to be first. I like being first. It's fun. Marcia would like to know, do you have a lot of book signings at bookstores or libraries, or how do you promote your books?
My publisher usually arranges them all. I just gotten off about a 3-week book tour, and I still have a few more stores to go to. And I love to talk at libraries because they tend to have really big audiences. So it's really, you know, I really have to give all the credit to my publisher, which is Random House.
You switched? Did you switch several publishers?
I've worked with 4 different publishers. I started off with Harlequin. I was briefly with Harper. Then I went to Simon & Schuster, and now I'm with Random House. It's a very small world out there, and you see the same people again and again.
It's difficult. So if somebody really wanted to, you know, it's hard because you're who you are to get a book published by Random House or Simon & Schuster or any of the big houses. But for someone that isn't that popular, it's hard to do that. So if you had to do it again from the beginning, would you go? One of the authors who I interviewed last week was Peter Lefcourt, and he was telling everybody about e-books and publishing on e. He took all of his books off of paperback.
Yeah.
Your books are e-books also, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're in all formats.
Do you feel that that's better as far as sales are concerned in order to get e-books and EPUBs and MOPIs and all of that? Rather than, I mean, I won't read a book unless it's in print because I get eye strain, and I just prefer having it so I could scribble in it and have fun. And I've seen people with their, you know, Kindles and iPads, and they, you know, can write in those too. It just doesn't seem the same as having the book in their hand. Which do you think is better when you promote sales, or doesn't it matter?
I don't think it matters. I think everybody mm-hmm. reads in a different way. I think it's important, though, I mean, for my readership, to have the option of going to print as well as e-books.
Yeah.
I found that over half of my books now are sold in e-form. So that's a general movement that we're seeing, I think, across the industry, is more and more people are buying e-readers. But there's always going to be a strong group of us, and I include myself in that, who I prefer a book. I like to have the print. And I like to be able to bend the pages. So, but I do, at the same time, I do understand why some writers might want to self-publish on e, because they feel they have more control.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, some publishers, you know, traditional publishers will put the book on e-books, and some people will just go ahead and do it on Smashwords or Kindle Publishing or Ego Books, and there's a whole bunch of other ones that they have. I know that. And they feel that that's a good way to start. But it's hard unless somebody knows that you're there. We have another question, okay, from Mary Kate. Do you plan on writing more independent books, you know, standalones, besides Rizzoli and Isles?
I would love to, but you know what? The problem is that they don't sell as well. And my publisher wants me to write the books that they think they can sell the most copies of. You know, my two favorite books that I ever wrote were Gravity and The Bone Garden. And those just did not sell as well as the Rizzoli and Isles books, and you know, it's really hard to talk a publisher into publishing those books that they know are just not going to do as well.
What about if you took, you know, one of those books and rewrote it and incorporated your favorite characters in it? Would it matter?
Well, that wouldn't work.
That wouldn't. But I love The Bone Garden was fantastic, and it, you know, a lot of research went into that, and it was my kind of book, and I couldn't put it down. It was before I started reviewing people; otherwise, there would be a review out there somewhere. But that was really, really good. But Last to Die really is my favorite of all of them because it deals with kids, and it really shows how fragile the lives of children are, and how easily they can fall apart. So if you could choose your audience, you would think that YAs could read this book, right?
Yeah, I think it'd be a perfect beginning for a YA reader because three of the main characters are, you know, 13 and 14.
Well, I'm going to see my nephews in 2 weeks. I think I'm going to bring it with me and see if I can. They probably will grab it out of my hand because they're readers like their aunts. They read a couple of books a week. I have another question.
Yeah.
From Delaney, have you ever thought of writing under a pseudonym and doing a different series so they don't know it's you, but I will know that?
Well, I don't write fast. I don't write fast enough. it's hard enough for me to write a book a year with the Rizzoli and Isles series, so I would mean I would have to kind of slip this in my free time, and I just can't do it. I'm a really slow writer. I just can't turn in a book faster than one a year.
Well, you know, that's because I was talking to someone else, and I found out that there is a whole bunch of things that you have to go through, correct? In other words, how many edits do you go through when you're going to do a book? And how do you know that there are no editorial problems or typos? Because I've reviewed almost 800 books, seriously. And there are some New York Times bestselling authors that do have typos in them, and it's not their fault. I blame it on the editor. And
yeah.
I never write that in a review. I think it's kind of rude to write that in a review that someone saw, you know, five typos or six, and it was on page 97. You know, you spelled that wrong, you left out the A. You know, sometimes it's a print setting kind of thing, too, and it's not their fault. So how do you know when you're done with the book? How many drafts do you do, and how many edits do you do?
Yeah, well, each book is different. Some books just need a lot more rewrites. I mean, because my first drafts are not, I mean, I don't plan them out ahead of time. I have a lot of revisions that need to, you know, I need to finish because of consistency to make sure the story hangs together. You know, sometimes you change things in the middle of writing that first draft. So I think probably I have an average of about five drafts on my own. And then I send it to my editor, and then, of course, there's one more rewrite because she'll make suggestions. But when you talk about typos, those are so easy to miss. I mean, I know that I've done this myself. I'll get a galley, you know, the typeset galley, and I'll read them. My editor will read them. Somebody else will read them. And we're all reading them multiple times, and we all miss the same typo. It's because our brain corrects without us realizing it.
Exactly.
So we may see a misspelled word, but our brain thinks that it's, you know, just corrects on our behalf, and we never see that typo.
Well, if you read it out loud, you probably still wouldn't see it either. But you would see grammar errors, right? You would, if you read the sentence out loud,
grammatical errors. That's right. You would pick that up much more easily.
I would think you would.
Even if a word is left out, again, your brain puts in that extra word and without you noticing it.
Well, yeah. For those of us that read a lot and that automatically know the way something is supposed to sound, yeah, it definitely would. So what I had this discussion with someone else too. The cover of your book. Who decides it? Do you decide it, or does the publishing company decide it? And what happens if you decide you don't like what they picked?
Well, they propose a cover for me. And if I don't like it, they'll go back to the drawing board. So, I mean, every so often I will turn down a cover. I'll say, no, that doesn't work for me, and they have to redo it. But every single one has been designed by the publisher.
And if you don't like it, they won't. Because someone had said to me, and I won't say who, that if they don't like if you don't like the cover of the book, would they pull the book? They won't.
No.
The cover
is decided way before the book is printed.
That's what I would think. It just didn't sound right when the person said, oh, you know what? They're going to, you know, pull my book if I don't, you know, like this or I don't like that.
Oh, I wonder if she just means they won't publish it.
They won't publish the book.
Yeah, that's maybe what she said.
Well, you know what? If you want the book published, sometimes you just have to go with whatever the publishing company says.
And you know how much power you have over that really depends on what your contract reads like. I mean, if your agent is really good, they can put that into your contract that the author must approve the cover.
I would think that they should. And I would think that the author has to approve any kind of editorial changes or story changes. Because when you hand send it to your editor, does she change the storyline or anything?
No, never. And she just gives me a list of questions or suggestions. It's up to me to make all the changes.
And if you don't want to, it doesn't matter, correct?
If I don't want to, then I'm the boss. So I get to, you know, keep it the way I want it.
Well, I would think you should, because the books are so good. You know, why would anybody want to change them? I mean, really, what are these people thinking? Now, let's go back to the television series. The television series is definitely not the same as the books. Do they ever use the same titles of your books in the stories?
No, the only book that they've used was The Apprentice, and that was used for the pilot episode.
And they haven't used anything since. I still think that they should give you a cameo, or they should do what Jessica Fletcher does and let you type as the credits are coming on at the beginning.
Yeah, I get the credits up, you know, based on the series of novels by, but they have their own team of writers. They write their own stories every week, and you know, they've made some obvious changes in the characters. And right now, Jane Rizzoli is, instead of a plain Jane, she's beautiful on TV. So that's just what television's like.
That's definitely not Jane Rizzoli. She's more like a Kathy and Lacey kind of character. Okay, we have one more question in the chat room. I'm going to announce the next 75 shows that I have to do.
Okay,
this is a very interesting question. I was trying to get this book, but it's almost impossible. Are you going to be reading the J.K. Rowling's new book, The Casual Vacancy? You are.
I'm just going to have to get a copy. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm hearing pretty good reviews on it.
Will she send it to you, or do you actually have to go buy this thing?
Oh, no, I've got to have to go out and buy it. I don't know, J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
No, I think no one really does. As a matter of fact, I got fooled because I, you know, found her fan page, and they actually answered me and said that if we knew her, you know, this is her fan page, we would send you her book to review. So if she's listening, I would like to review your book, you know, because I don't go out and buy them anymore. I just actually have no time to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's... And you're still not getting your cameo. That's just a hint to the producers that I think it's about time. And
well,
what
you
else
know,
would you like?
They offered me, but I would have to show up at a certain time, and I'd have to tell them when I was coming. So, you know what? It's an open offer for me to do a cameo, but I just haven't had a chance to yet.
Where did they film this?
It's all filmed in Los Angeles. That's where the cast and crew lives, and that's where they want to keep it.
I see. That's pretty good. I'm going to take a break for 1 second. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to announce my other shows, and then we're going to come up with a few more questions, if I can remember what I'm doing next week. Okay, on Tuesday at 4 o'clock, I'm going to interview a multi-talented thriller author, Gerard de Marini, at 4 o'clock, Rise to the Call. On October 9th, Marcia Cook is going to host a show for book reviewers. Karen Vaughn, Delaney Oakes, myself, and let's see if we can get Karina to do this show. We're going to talk about book reviews and fake reviews and authors that write their own reviews. That was my next question. Authors that write their own reviews about their own books and under pseudonyms and different names. On October 17th, I'm going to be interviewing FBI agent Michael Tabman, and before him, Dr. Jenny Tates, and her book is about something about nutrition, and if they would send it to me, that would be nice. The next day on October 18th, New York Times bestselling author Larry Thompson, Dead Peasants, and Iris Johansson in her new book, which I shall be receiving next week and read and review, hopefully, before the show. That's what's coming up. And on November 1st, Marcia Cook and I are going to do a very special show to honor the memory of Laura Terenzano, who was a newscaster for Newsday newspaper. She was a journalist, and she died of lung cancer. And we're going to talk about her book, My Life with Cancer. Her father, Frank, wrote it with another man named Paul Londo. And we're going to be talking about lung cancer since November 1st, and November is Lung Cancer Month. So we're going to talk about that particular book, which I just reviewed, and we're going to talk about the hazards of smoking. So that's what's coming up. Just a few things for book discussion and myself, and I hope everybody tunes in. If there are any more questions now, okay, so we know where we can get, and but you're not going to tell us the title of your next book, right?
I don't know it yet.
Okay, so if you're going to bring Julian back with Tan to work together, where do you see Julian next?
I see Julian eventually going to college. I think he's going to be an interesting kid in college. He'll probably go to college in Boston. He'll probably hang out with Maura a lot, and he may become important to crime solving in the future.
Okay, that is very, very true. I would like to thank you so much for this interview. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry I didn't know about that, the two-hour thing. But
she told me after. And J.D. Holliday has her show on Saturday at 10, has a show with Mary Snyder. I think I got that right. And Marcia, are there any other shows? You need to put them in the search in the chat room so I remember. Marcia and Virginia are the World of Ink, and they have given me the show, and I am so excited because this is great. And when is your next book coming out so I'm ready so I can email you and, you know, I can
no,
get
I
you.
Don't. I don't. I have
you
to
have
write
no
it. I have to write it.
You have to finish writing it. Okay, so if you ever decide that you want to do one of your books that didn't sell, or a series of romance novels, just send them all to me. You know I'm going to read them in 5 minutes, no problem.
Okay.
Good book. Thank you so much, Tess. I appreciate this so very, very much. Is there anything that you want to add or anything I didn't ask?
No, I just want to say hi to all my readers, and thank you for a great hour.
Thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. And Marcia and Virginia will be on tomorrow at noon, Central. And thank you very much, everybody. And good night. Have a great evening. Bye.
Bye-bye.